Welcome and Happy New Year. This is Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. First up, the Shinnecock Nation Fights State of New York Over Science and Sovereignty by Levi Rickert. The Shinnecock Indian Nation's battle to keep its two electronic signs operational will move to federal court next Tuesday. The tribal nation located about 90 miles east of Manhattan at the gateway to the Hamptons on Long Island is a federally recognized tribe in an area known for estates owned by the wealthy and famous. At issue is a New York State court ruling earlier last year that found the tribe did not have the right to construct and operate the billboards and ordered them shut down. Last month, the judge in the case said the company that operates the billboards and sells advertising on them was in contempt of court and again demanded that the signs be shut down. On Tuesday, December 23, 2025, the Shinnecock Nation fought back by filing a federal lawsuit against New York State, claiming the state illegally created an easement across the tribe's Westwoods land in Hampton Bays when it extended Sunrise Highway past Hampton Bays in 1958. The easement case returns to federal court in Central Islip on Tuesday, December 30th, Shinnecock Vice Chairman Lance Gumbs told NBC New York. The lawsuit's case includes proposed subpoenas for Governor Kathy Hochul, State Attorney General Letitia James, and State Transportation Commissioner Marie-Therese Dominguez. A spokesperson for Attorney General James referred News 4 to the governor's office and the New York State Department of Transportation for comment. However, a spokesperson for Governor Hochul declined to comment on behalf of those agencies, citing pending litigation. The tribe has asked the federal court to immediately issue a restraining order against the state, prohibiting it from forcing the tribe to turn off the signs, which have been in place since they were constructed in 2019. The suit reiterates a longstanding claim by the tribe that when the State Department of Transportation extended Sunrise Highway to Southampton, it effectively seized dozens of acres of tribal land without proper authorization from the nation's recognized leaders and without the permission of the U.S. Congress, in direct violation of constitutional requirements governing dealings with Native American tribes. The state seeks to prohibit the nation from operating the monument signs it developed based on a false claim that the state has legal easement over the restricted fee lands, known as Westwoods Territory, the lawsuit states. Not so. These are the nation's protected lands, and the state failed to seek consent of Congress for its purported easement. The Shinnecock Indian Nation has an agreement with an advertising company that manages the two signs. Proceeds from the advertising go to the tribe as part of its economic development efforts. Ironically, even with resistance to the signs, the state of New York paid for advertising to provide COVID-19 guidance on the signs during the pandemic. Next up, Ute Tribe files federal lawsuit challenging Colorado parks legislation by Native News Online staff. The Ute Indian Tribe of the Unetah and Orsay Reservation filed a federal lawsuit Friday against Colorado Governor Jared Polis, Democrat, and heads of the Colorado Department of Natural Resources and Colorado Parks and Wildlife, alleging a state law unlawfully denies the tribe equal access to ancestral lands. The lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court of the District of Colorado on December 19, 2025, challenges the constitutionality and application of House Bill 25-1163, now codified as CRS 33-12-1003.8. The law provides free access to Colorado state parks for members of the Southern Ute Indian Tribe and the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, but not the Ute Indian Tribe of the Unetah and Oray Reservation. The tribe argues the exclusion is discriminatory and ignores its deep historical and cultural ties to lands that include many of Colorado's state parks. According to the complaint, much of the land covered by the legislation lies within the historic Aboriginal territory of the Ute bands that today comprise the tribe. The filing follows the tribe's public condemnation of the bill in May of 2025, when leaders described it as perpetuating cultural and historical genocide. The tribe says it requests inclusion during the legislative process and proposed amendments documenting its longstanding connection to the land, but the Colorado General Assembly declined to incorporate those changes. The lawsuit alleges violations of multiple federal laws, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bruneau Agreement, a federal agreement signed off by all Ute bands that reserved hunting, fishing, and gathering rights to ceded lands that now include Colorado state parks. The complaint also argues the law places an undue burden on tribal members seeking access to sacred sites in their traditional homelands. The Ute people are the oldest continuous residents of what is now Colorado, according to the tribe. In 1880, bands that now make up the Ute Indian tribe were forcibly removed at gunpoint to the Unitah and Ouray Reservation in Utah. Tribal Chairman Sean Chapoos said the legislation fails to acknowledge that history. Colorado's park bill is a broken promise codified into law. It is shameful. It acknowledges that profound ties to our homeland while demanding our exiled tribe pay an entrance fee to visit our own sacred grounds from which they drove us. We will not stand idly by and pay for the same privilege to access our places to pray, to hunt, to fish. We will not be erased by Colorado from these lands, Chapoos said. The lawsuit seeks a court declaration requiring the state to revise CRS 33-12-103.8 to include the Ute Indian Tribe of the Unitah and Ouray Reservation. Next up, Native Americans could be hit hard as Education Department resumes student loan wage garnishment, by Native News Online staff. On December 23, 2025, the U.S. Department of Education said it will begin administrative wage garnishment for borrowers with defaulted federal student loans in early 2026, marking the first resumption of such collections since the pandemic-era pause that began in 2020. The first round of garnishment notices is scheduled to be sent out the week of January 7, 2026, according to the department. About 1,000 borrowers in default will receive notices in initial wave, with the number increasing each month throughout 2026 as the agency expands enforcement efforts. Under federal law, the government may order employers to withhold up to 15% of a borrower's disposable income, pay remaining after legally required deductions to be applied toward unpaid federal student loan debt. Administrative wage garnishment allows the government to collect without obtaining a court order. Borrowers are generally considered in default after failing to make required payments for at least 270 days, or roughly 9 months. Once in default, borrowers may face additional consequences beyond wage garnishment, including the loss of eligibility for federal student aid and damage to their credit. The Department of Education paused most collection activities in March 2020 as part of the pandemic relief measures. The resumption of garnishment signals a broader return to pre-pandemic enforcement practices as federal student loan policies continue to evolve. Precise real-time counts of Native American borrowers who are behind on federal student loan payments are not consistently available in federal reports. However, existing research shows that American Indian and Alaska Native borrowers experience the highest rates of repayment difficulty among all racial groups. As of 2025, available data paint a stark picture of student loan delinquency and default among Native American borrowers. About 2 in 5, or roughly 40%, of American Indian and Alaska Native students default on their student loans, according to research cited by higher education analysts. Among borrowers who entered college during the 2011-2012 academic year, more than 70% to 70.7% had used forbearance within 6 years, the highest rate of any racial group. Heavy reliance on forbearance often signals financial distress and can lead to higher overall loan balances. Impact on Native Americans. Native American borrowers also tend to carry their debt longer. 4 years after graduation, they typically still owe about 87% of their original loan balance, compared with about 73% for white borrowers. National data from 2024 and 2025 show that roughly 20% of all federal student loan borrowers are behind on their payments, while federal data sets often omit detailed racial breakdowns for Native Americans in recent years. Historical trends suggest their arrears rate remain well above the national average, driven in part by persistent economic barriers in many tribal communities. Borrowing is also widespread. About 62% of Native American students take out student loans to finance their education, underscoring their disproportionate impact that renewed federal collection efforts may have on Native communities. Department of Education officials have encouraged borrowers in default to explore options to avoid garnishment, including loan rehabilitation, consolidation, or income-driven repayment plans, which may allow borrowers to bring loans back into good standing. Up next, from dishwasher to award-winning chef, Laguna Pueblo's Josh Aragon serves up Albuquerque's best green chili stew. By Sean Griswold. At the award-winning Indian Pueblo Kitchen, Chef Josh Aragon stood with a smile at the fresh bowl of green chili stew in front of him for a photo shoot celebrating the dish being named the best in the city by Albuquerque the magazine. A chef from Laguna Pueblo, Aragon started as a dishwasher in the kitchen 5 years ago. He worked his way up through the cook line and now runs the kitchen that serves traditional Pueblo food to global visitors at their restaurant in Albuquerque, New Mexico. "I've worked hard in the kitchen, here just to make all the food great, from the chili stew to the pozole," he told Native News Online. "I am very happy. I even complimented my staff because they're the ones that are doing it, not me. I teach them. They keep producing." Being named the best chili is a major achievement in a chili-obsessed population, where the official state question in New Mexico asks, "Red or green chili?" At the Pueblo-run restaurant, the answer is both. "The smile on my face says it all," Aragon said. "I would say the chili is not too hot or too spicy, but it has the flavor. A lot of people, they don't like hot. They don't like spicy, but they love the ingredients. They love the taste." The restaurant is located inside the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, just a mile east of the Rio Grande, and is operated by the 19 Pueblos. It's a central location to conveniently access a contemporary and traditional Pueblo experience. At the center, there is a museum with a permanent and rotating art gallery from Native American creatives. A library houses resources that include archival material from the Albuquerque Indian Boarding School, which was once operated on the grounds. One building remains from that era, which now serves as the home for the Native American Community Academy. Next door to the school is a federal building. A shopping center and convenience store, also operated by the Pueblos, fill out the rest of the area. You're listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. At the Pueblo Kitchen, Aragon also has access to a nearby garden that grows crops like corn, beans, squash, and garlic. The garden is an educational tool that brings Native farmers and students to learn about indigenous agricultural practices. "We usually get the vegetables from the garden, usually tomatoes, some cilantro, maybe squash, whatever comes to whatever's in season at the time," he said. "As Native people, we understand that food comes from our Mother Earth. I like to get the younger people in here to learn about cultivating or gardening and just using what you have as you plant. You can have very little in your garden, but still make a nice indigenous meal." Back inside the kitchen, head baker Rita Toledo prepares loaves of oven bread into slices that go with each bowl of stew. "I just love baking oven bread," Toledo Jimenez Pueblo told Native News Online. "My grandmother taught me how to do it." She said the kitchen serves at least 500 loaves of bread each week. We use three simple ingredients, water, flour, and canola oil, she said. That's it. Oven bread and stews are keystone dishes served at any Pueblo function, like ceremonies, weddings, feast days, birthdays, and holidays. Toledo also bakes cookies and small fruit-filled pies, which are sold at the restaurant and across the city, including a new Pueblo kitchen located inside the Albuquerque Sunport. She enthusiastically shared a story from a friend who stopped at the airport location. She bought a loaf of bread and took it to Germany, Toledo said. It's so cool to know someone liked it that much that they wanted to take our bread across the world. I'm honored. The kitchen's ingredients and hearty meals provide healthy diet options. The space gives people career options with an employer that shares cultural values and accentuate Pueblo communities. Aragon runs a kitchen with other Pueblo people, and that background ties him and the others in the kitchen to another layer of healthy lifestyle that promote total well-being of the individual, which complements the nutritional benefits of fresh traditional food. To move beyond practices that sought to erase Native people and culture, it's important to be present, to show up and share with others, Aragon lamented when he described his ascent in the kitchen. A fried egg was the first thing I learned to cook at home, Aragon said. Here, when I first started, I wasn't really cooking. I was watching everybody as they were preparing foods, as they were getting their meals ready, smelling just the ingredients that go into all their work and everything. Another chef in the kitchen asked Aragon if he wanted to step up. He said yes. I started in the back as a prep cook, and then just learning the ingredients, the recipes, teaching others too as we go along, he said. And it really helps a lot because learning from the bottom up, you know everything that you know, everything that you take and have, and you can share it with others. Communication is the key here. It's a lot of everybody working as a team. Here, it's like family. Up next. Indian country faces crippling premiums under expired Affordable Care Act credits. By Elise Wild. As millions of Americans rang in the new year on January 1st, Affordable Care Act ACA subsidies expired, passing on soaring premiums to the millions of Americans who purchase health coverage through the marketplace. What are the subsidies? The subsidies in question, enhanced premium tax credits, PTCs, are a result of COVID-era legislation, the American Rescue Plan Act. The credits provided low to no cost premiums for low and middle income families. In 2022, the PTCs were extended through 2025. What happened? Last fall, lawmakers fought over subsidy extension, leading to the longest government shutdown in history. In December, Congress went on recess without passing legislation to extend the subsidies. The expired credits have left policyholders facing premiums that are double, sometimes triple, their previous amount. The financial strain could force people to give up their plans. What does this mean for Indian country? Access to healthcare has long been a barrier in Indian country, in part driving high rates of chronic illness and the shortest lifespans of any demographic in the United States. Native people access healthcare through an amalgamation of the Indian Health Service, tribal health services, Medicaid coverage, and ACA plans. According to the Urban Institute, 318,000 Native American people were enrolled in ACA plans, and the Urban Institute estimates that 126,000 of those will lose their coverage without the tax credits. The impact could extend beyond policyholders. The chronically underfunded IHS relies on third-party billing, generating $1.8 billion in 2023, significantly bridging the huge funding gaps that plague the agency. Lawmakers are expected to come to an agreement in January or February 2026, potentially retroactively addressing the premium increase. Up next, Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell proved representation matters, by Levi Rickert. Opinion. Even after retiring from the U.S. Senate in 2005, former Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who passed away on December 30, 2025, remained a familiar presence in Indian country. He was easy to spot in the crowd. At White House Tribal Nations conferences during the Obama administration, at the National Congress of American Indians State of Indian Nations address in Washington, D.C., and at Indian Gaming Association conventions. By the time I founded Native American Online in February of 2011, Campbell had been out of the Senate for 6 years. Until then, I knew him only through news accounts and books. I first met him at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. during a State of Indian Nations event. Handsome and dignified, he sat quietly as a steady stream of well-wishers stopped to greet him. I approached him with a sense of awe, regarding him as a Native statesman among tribal leaders. After all, he became the first Native American senator in more than six decades, a Northern Cheyenne man who served as one of 44 members of the tribe's Council of Chiefs. We exchanged business cards, and he told me Indian Country needed more news coverage and to keep going, adding that he appreciated my efforts. In reality, I was the one who deeply appreciated his efforts during his service in Congress, both in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. His career embodied a simple but powerful truth: representation matters. His legislative record spoke for itself. He co-authored the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988, one of the most consequential laws for tribal nations, a transformative measure that helped move some tribes from poverty to prosperity. In 1991, he also co-authored legislation renaming Custer Battlefield National Monument to Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, believing the original name reflected a one-sided and inaccurate telling of American history. As the only Native American to chair the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs for more than half of his 12 years in the U.S. Senate, Campbell led bipartisan efforts to advance tribal sovereignty and expand access to health care, education, and infrastructure in Native communities. Campbell was a chief sponsor of the legislation that authorized and funded the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian on the National Mall, ensuring Native cultures and histories were honored in a major national institution. He also helped transform Great Sand Dunes National Monument into Great Sand Dunes National Park in southern Colorado. Campbell also worked on the creation of the Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site, preserving a key site in American and Native history. Campbell's congressional efforts extended beyond Native American issues. In the 106th Congress, he ranked first among all senators and House members for passing the most standalone pieces of legislation into law, demonstrating his effectiveness in getting bills enacted. Through his role on the Appropriation Committee and other panels, he helped pass measures such as the Bulletproof Vest Partnership Act, improving safety for small police departments and tribal law enforcement agencies. Campbell also served on the State Veterans Affairs Committee, contributing to veterans policy. In retirement as an elder Native statesman among tribal leaders, he could have easily said, "Been there, done that." Instead, he carried himself with quiet dignity, speaking when approached. For years, he and his wife Linda were guests of the Indian Gaming Association at its annual conventions. The late IGA chairman Ernie Stevens Jr. made certain the former senator was honored for his vast contributions to Indian gaming, recognizing that Campbell fought to preserve and strengthen Indian gaming even as it remained under constant attack after the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed in 1988. So yes, I was in awe of Senator Campbell upon meeting him. I noticed when he talked he had a twinkle in his eye, which I took for him being a wise man. We developed a friendship that involved mutual respect through his latter years that allowed me to call him for opinions and background on issues. We shared common thoughts on the need to preserve tribal sovereignty and ensure progress is being made for Indian Country. I was honored when he agreed to write the foreword to my book, Visions for a Better Indian Country, One Potawatomi's Opinions. In his first paragraph, he wrote, "Levi Rickard is a friend of mine. He is a man I respect and trust. By the second paragraph, he made it clear that he and I did not agree on everything. But he wrote, I agree with him 90% of the time. This is a good thing. In this day and age of canceling those who do not see things 100% our way, it is very good that in Indian country, we can agree on most things and disagree on others, yet give our brothers and sisters the opportunity to speak their mind and perhaps change our minds in the process. This nugget of wisdom is needed in this current age of polarization across political spectrums. After learning of Campbell's death on Tuesday, I reread his words again. With his passing, the words became more meaningful to me than when I first read them. On Saturday evening, I spoke with Dave Devendorf, who served as Senator Campbell's chief of staff and remained close to him until his death. We agreed there will never be another Ben Nighthorse Campbell, a Native man who represented Indian country with wisdom, dignity, and that unmistakable twinkle in his eye. Next up, Klamath Indigenous Land Trust purchases 10,000 acres as salmon return. By Native News Online staff. As salmon returned to the headwaters of the Klamath River for the first time in more than a century, the newly formed Klamath Indigenous Land Trust and PacifiCorps announced the purchase of 10,000 acres in and around the river's former reservoir reach. The deal is one of the largest private land purchases by an Indigenous-led land trust in U.S. history. Dam removal allowed the salmon to return home. Returning these lands to Indigenous care ensures that home will be a place where they can flourish and recover, said Molly Myers Carrick, president of the Klamath Indigenous Land Trust Board of Directors. Our community spent generations fighting for this moment, and we honor our ancestors who carried this vision forward. The healing that's underway is real, and this acquisition reflects the future we're building together as people of the Klamath Basin. PacifiCorps, the former landowner, partnered with the land trust to complete the sale following a decades-long Indigenous-led effort to remove four dams on the Klamath River, a project completed last year. The purchase includes lands upstream of and adjacent to the former hydropower project that are considered critical to the river's long-term health and its fisheries. The transfer places stewardship of the land under Indigenous values and ecological restoration goals for the first time in more than a century. PacifiCorps is gratified to see these lands transition to a stewardship model that honors their cultural and ecological significance, said Ryan Flynn, president of Pacific Power, the PacifiCorps division serving customers in California, Oregon, and Washington. We recognize the leadership of the Klamath Basin tribes and Kilt in shaping a restoration vision that will benefit the entire region. The Klamath Indigenous Land Trust was formed by leaders from four Klamath Basin tribes who began working together after the 2002 fish kill. They spent the next two decades advancing a grassroots movement to remove the dams and restore salmon runs. We are from different tribes and we each have our own cultural traditions. But it was through working together and by bringing tribal people from all over the basin together that created this moment, said Wendy Ferris George, Hoopa Karak, vice president of the Kilt Board. With the acquisition complete, the land trust plans to develop comprehensive land management plans with input from area tribes. The plans will focus on habitat recovery, protection of cultural resources, fire management, and public access. This is the next chapter in the Klamath River's renewal, said board member Jeff Mitchell, Klamath Bodoc. It's proof that Indigenous leadership and community partnerships can achieve transformational change at a landscape scale. Funding for the purchase was provided by the Katina Foundation, the Community Foundation of New Jersey, and an anonymous donor. You've been listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Join us next time for an upcoming episode. Music is Land Back by Hallucination.